Hello, we're jumping in before this episode to give you a very special, massive announcement.
Announcement.
It's merchandise time.
We're for the first time ever releasing Sci Guys merch. How cool is that? Sci Guys merch that you can get. You can get it at normalcitizen.score.
.store.
It is on the screen. It is linked in the description.
Ooh.
It is very, very fun and very cool. What merch have we got coming up?
Hat. Wait, I was going to say a beanie, but yeah, it's a hat.
We've got a tardigrade beanie. We've got a tardigrade t-shirt. Two different designs. They're similar, but very cool. Matching ones. I think you should get them both. We've also got what else?
Calendar.
Calendars.
A calendar. That is pretty darn cool. You get to see Sci Guys every single day of the year. You get to plan us into your every single week. And also, last but not least,
a Sci Guys pin badge.
Dun, 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 dun.
A Sci Guys pin badge? That's pretty darn cool. This one is a very simple Sci Guys logo pin badge. But that's not all. That's the very start of the pin badges. If you like these pin badges, you get all the pin badges, we might just release more.
Dun, 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 dun.
Collectible pin badges? I think so. Get down to the link in the description right this very second.
Right now, immediately.
Get them.
And if you do it right this very second now, when this video comes out, you will get a very special pre-order discount. And if you're a patron of ours, you'll get something even better. You'll get a patron discount on top of the pre-order discount. How cool is that?
Double discount. Discount.
Do not tarry. Be very quick, because this pre-order discount is not going to last very long. I won't tell you when it's going to end, but it's going to end very, very soon. So get down to the website right now and get your stuff before it goes, because this is limited edition. We are not making any more. Once it's gone, it is gone. Go get it. What are we starting with this week?
We review.
How do you know that?
Don't know. Intuition.
Yeah, intuition.
Luke said it.
Yeah. Also, I said it.
How do you know?
Because Corey said it
a minute ago. Okay. So this one comes from Diabetic Dog Walk. I didn't read that until right now.
What identity?
From Diabetic Dog Walker. It says, I'm back. It's 5 stars. I used to listen to this all the time on my commute. And then I had a long break from this podcast because I had a year off work due to having a baby. Now I've actually gone back to university and this is my favorite thing to listen to on my commute again. I have so many episodes to catch up on too. Yeah. I'm so happy you're still going and you're still as funny as you've always been. Even after a stressful uni day when my deadlines have piled up, this podcast always puts a smile on my face. Brill job, guys. Keep it up.
Yay!
You've got so much catching up to do.
Wow, so much. That's nice, isn't it? We've done a lot in a year, haven't we? But 52 episodes.
52 episodes. To be
congratulations on having an infant. Well done.
And before we start the show, I do want to let everyone know you should probably join our Discord. It's quite nice, a little Discord over there where you can chat and do things and, you know, talk about this episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Please do.
Yeah. Cool. So we start the show?
No, Corey, we shan't start the show. You haven't asked a question.
Goodness me, I have not asked a question. Let me ask a question now.
Go on then. Please.
How old were you when you had your first sexual sex? When you had sex? How old were you?
Sexual sex.
People aren't going to share that in the comments on a YouTube
video. Well, they are.
Oh, God.
How old were you? And if you don't want to share it, just put a random number. Put your favorite number. Let people guess.
What if your favorite number is like a low number?
And you let people guess. Let's start the show. Hello and welcome to The Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird, and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Jamp and Luke Cutforth, and this time, very special guest, Ian.
Hey! Hey! That's me.
This week, we're talking about first times.
Ooh. Are we?
Okay.
Yeah, we are.
Could not have guessed from the question at the top of the episode.
The question does make sense now.
It does make sense now, right?
Yeah, seems pretty out of there.
Don't thank me for this episode. Thank Ian over here. Why should we thank Ian for this episode, Ian?
So, I wrote a paper during my master's degree in health psychology. And the paper was on reflections of first same-sex sexual experiences among LGBT individuals, the preparation that they felt societally and educationally to allow them to access that in a healthy, safe, and also enjoyable way, and any barriers that people had to that experience. So, yeah, it's a very long paper, though. So if you want to read it, be my guest. I'm not going to.
In short, they spoke to a lot of gay people about having sex.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, basically. So it was a qualitative paper rather than a quantitative one. I don't know if you know the difference between those.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. So it was a lot of transcribing and a lot of rooting through to find commonalities, less data crunching, which is actually where my expertise and my preference lies. I really like statistics, but there was just no groundwork done in the scientific community prior. So I was like, I have to just do the groundwork.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Luke, for the audience, what is the difference between the quantitative and the qualitative? Yeah. Oh, Luke can give it a go.
So qualitative data is basically like people's experiences, like information on first-hand experiences. Quantitative data is numbers that you can actually analyze and are more objective most of the time.
So whether or not they're more objective is a very interesting debate, because ultimately data always relies on context. Mm. And so you'll find a lot of qualitative studies where as soon as you read the survey and read the questionnaire and read the interpretations that have been made from those raw results, there's been a lot of human bias in there, and a lot of because to create the, especially in psychology, to create a questionnaire, to create a survey, you need to have a base theory, and that base theory is always dependent on what the researcher already believes, which is why it's the qualitative stuff is based more on subjective experiences, but because you get much richer data from that, it can be more accurate to what people actually experience.
I think people find it easier to pull more objective data from quantitative research because you've got a lot of numbers, and you can say, here are a lot of individual experiences based on this one variable. And obviously there's bias in all data, because we speak about that literally all the time. There's bias in all data, but I think the reason people think it's more objective is just because it's easier to look at all these experiences through this one lens, rather, whereas qualitative, it's very much, gosh, there's a lot to read through, isn't there?
Yeah.
Would you be able to pull quantitative data from qualitative
yeah,
data?
Yeah, so there's types of, it's hard to say, so there's types of qualitative research methods. So in the same way that you've got different potential ways of doing quantitative data, you've got a bunch of different ways of doing qualitative ones, which vary on kind of what you're looking for and how you look for it. But there's one, I can't remember the name of it, but it's based on basically counting the number of occurrences. So if someone was looking at speech fillers in linguistics, you can count how many times someone says someone says and that kind of thing. But because you have long interview structures, that's a little bit, that's a really bad example, but that's an example of it.
Just the example I was thinking was like, I don't know specifically, we'll find out what your paper was, but one of the things you hear about a lot with LGBT communities, we don't get like educated on any type of sex other than heterosexual sex, or at least I didn't at school, as far as I remember. And so like one, you could pull the quantitative data of like whether somebody felt adequately prepared for their first time sexual experience out of qualitative data of like in an interview about their first experience.
Yeah, so you could have a little checkbox and say, okay, this person didn't feel like they got any education at all surrounding LGBT sexual health. And you could do a little checkbox exercise like that. But ultimately the issue is when it comes to qualitative data, because you're doing such rich data, you only have a participant pool that's much smaller, unless you have a huge research team. Mm. So I had 17 participants, which is a big study for qualitative. There are some that go up to like 32, 34, but it generally is a much smaller sample size. So you can't really find those. That's another reason why people think it's more objective. You can find much more generalizations and generalizability from quantitative stuff, because you're doing like, you know, hundreds or thousands of people all at once. So you can get a lot more from those people, whereas qualitative, because it's so small, you could, but it would be like, okay, 50% isn't a necessarily accurate representation of the general population.
I think if you think of it as like a trade-off, right? Mm. In terms of, you can get, like you're saying, there's a lot of rich data from qualitative. So in those sort of, what is it, in those 17 people, you've got so many different data points. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it really difficult to sort of use that data in the same way that you'd use sort of quantitative data. But if you've got a quantitative paper, you could basically be getting like maybe 4 or 5 bits of data from them, but from like hundreds and so it's a trade-off, right?
It's
a way to think about it. There you go. Should we get into the actual study?
Yes, now please. We've done the methodology section. Let's go.
No, so the sort of aim of it. I mean, I've got the aim.
The actual aim.
I've literally got the aim that you've got written here. Yeah. We could go through that, or do you want to give a?
I can give a brief overview of what the
Give a brief overview, and I will test you. And if you get it wrong,
I can't recite it by rote if that's what you're asking me to do.
No, just give it over to you.
The point was, so I was looking to do research into the LGBT community, and there's a lot of pre-existing research on the context and experiential outcomes, which is how someone experienced after into heterosexual sex. And by that I mean specifically male and female as predicated by the traditional gender binary, having sex with each other, and I don't know if this counts as swearing. It's just science. Penile vaginal sex,
yeah,
and so
that's totally fine.
When it comes to that, I get nervous because it's like, oh, you know, some people have different beliefs and stuff. But anyway, so that's pretty much the entire data pool, and there is lots of data into that because ultimately the field of sexual health was always derived from initially stopping premarital sex, then to, or the dangers of it, then to preventing STIs, preventing unwanted pregnancies. But now it's moving into a more holistic field. There is just no real data onto the first time on LGBT, same-sex sexual experience, same-sex slash gender, I would say. And so what we wanted to do is we wanted to create that research pool. There is a couple, I found like two papers into LGBT first same-sex experiences. One was from a long while ago and it didn't feel representative. It felt very biased. And the other one was entirely quantitative. And the issue with that is I felt they were modeling LGBT experiences on the heterosexual norm. And so ultimately you're going to be missing a lot of stuff rather than going into that exploratory thing first. So we wanted to explore the various aspects of this in order to create that base to then find models or kind of ways of thinking about first times among the LGBT community.
Yeah.
That's not even a brief overview. It's very, very dense overview.
When you're talking about like thinking about first time, is it about like, what is it about? Like, is it about how you feel about it later on down the line?
So it's.
I've got some of the questions that you asked.
Yeah, we can. So ultimately, one major thing. Well, so it's how you felt, if you felt prepared going into it, how you felt you were able to engage during it, and how you feel about it looking back, or if it had any ramifications afterwards. So there's this point in first sex research called affective outcomes, effective responses rather. So affective with an A meaning emotional or kind of, and the affect is a general umbrella term for anything, emotions, moods, impulses. So you've got someone's affect. That's where we get the word affectionate from. So affective responses, if someone has a negative affective response to their first sex, their later sex will be less healthy. They would have a less healthy relationship with it. And it's a good baseline to understand if someone will need to put work in to overcome any kind of barriers to engaging sex in the future. And so effective outcome is like immediately afterwards, if you have a negative response, guilt, shame, regret, any of these things, that can then impact your later sexual health. And so you look at societally, there is a lot of pressure on LGBT people to conform to heteronormativity, which then might induce a larger array of shame or guilt or something after that experience. And so we're looking at seeing if there is that there, but also looking back. So if you felt looking back, that situation was a safe one or a healthy one, because in the moment, it's a little bit harder to judge. Obviously, all our participants were between the ages of 18 and 25. So they were all 26.
Yeah.
Sorry, 18 and 26. Oh, God. I'm already failing. I'll leave. So they were all reflecting on something that for some of them happened a couple of years ago, for some of them happened quite a while ago. So it's a little bit of memory differences. But ultimately, yeah, it's about looking back. How did you feel about it looking back now? So those are the general questions and some demographic stuff as well, obviously.
Right. So why don't we talk about the design of the study then?
Okay.
Yeah. So you've already said that the participants were between 18. Well, you were looking for participants between 18 and 26. I mean, obviously, in reality, I think they were the youngest was sort of what, 19?
Yeah. The youngest was 19. The eldest was 24.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I had 2 24-year-olds. Yeah, I've got the list right here.
Yeah.
I love the power of the actual information.
Well, actually, I've got it here.
Yeah, we did this with Jamie 2 weeks ago. Jamie wrote his PhD thesis a while ago, and I had it all sitting in front of me. And we had Baland the week before that, I think, as well.
Yeah.
Who had written those papers many years ago, and I had the data sitting in front of me. Felt very powerful. But so the participants, you had you were looking for people between the ages of 18 and 26. Do you want to explain why you were looking for specifically?
Yeah, so ultimately we had to limit how many people we had. And we picked that age group because we felt that they were going to be the most reflective of what is kind of currently going on in the education system that wouldn't require extra consent from parents to participate. But also we wanted a little bit of gap from when it happened so you could be a little bit more objective about it and not in that moment. But we didn't go much further because ultimately we needed a limit on the type of people we were talking to. So we had this kind of general, these people might have experienced roughly the same thing in school, roughly the same thing societally during this period. So that's why we picked that age range.
Yeah. Mm. And it's interesting though as well, because this 18 to 26, that means that none of them really would have been affected other than the first years of school. None of them would have been affected by Section 28, which is really, and I think it would be really interesting to do this because I think just 2019, they brought in, there's no mandatory LGBT sex education in schools.
Mm. So.
Oh, great.
The mandatory, it's already very dubious. So the issue with that law is if you actually look at the legislation, it says, but it is up to the school to determine what that looks like, which ultimately has been the case for a very long time. That's been the case for a very long time, because when Section 28 got repealed in 2001, until 2019, there was no guidance other than, yeah, you probably should. But ultimately, they weren't affected directly by Section 28. Teachers could talk freely about it. But after 2001, the majority of kids just didn't get anything because teachers are overburdened anyway. And so they aren't going to be able to. For some of the sex ed that I experienced was awful. So
the closest I got to LGBT sex ed was draw the stereotypical image of a lesbian and a gay person onto this teddy bear.
Draw it on a teddy bear.
Oh, sorry. I should point out that at this point, I was about between the ages of 13 and 15.
Yeah.
I was not a child. Mm. They asked us to draw, on a printout of a teddy bear, draw what a gay person would look like and what a lesbian would look like.
What do they mean by that?
I have no idea. They wanted to, so it was an idea of like, oh, here are the stereotypes of gay people and lesbians. What do you think they are? Draw them.
And this is the major issue.
Yeah, it was so strange.
But yeah, that's a major issue with sex ed. Yeah. That like when it comes to LGBT stuff, it gets treated as a stereotype session of, you know, trying to reduce stigma. And when you're talking about heterosexual sex, it's all in biology. Mm. It's all very much, this is how reproduction works. And neither of those are sufficient for helping someone guide themselves through any experience in a healthy and safe way. But they also frame these things differently, as in, this is the objectively right thing to do because we're teaching it in biology. And this is the nice, airy-fairy, oh, this is polite side. Mm. And so ultimately, the LGBT people in that classroom don't get their identity validated in a objective way from science. But yeah, and then the heterosexual people, they don't get any, you know, socially conscious teaching about how to engage properly in sex.
Some people do some of these things, and it's just leave them be. Yeah,
for us it was always like, you could have sex and do this, and you can also have anal sex, and then you can do this, and sometimes you do that. Like it's always this little add-on at the end. Yeah. And like, and some people are gay too.
Oh yeah, and also, yeah.
Yeah. So like, here's the whole lesson. Like this is the whole lesson about like relationships, being a young person, all of this. And some people are gay. Now, next lesson, moving on.
I spoke to quite a couple people who were, who went to religious schools.
Oh, dear.
And so a lot of them were saying that one person, apparently the sole piece of sex, this is what they actually said, the sole piece of sex education they had around LGBT sex was that it is difficult. That was it.
I have a story. I went to a Baptist school for 1 year, and in sex ed, we got told that gay people make bad life choices, and that was all we learned about gay people.
Can I? Yeah. I don't think
they make bad life choices in general.
Yeah, that's untrue.
Invest poorly in the stock market. They don't save for retirement.
We did the sex ed as normal, and then a student asked, "What about gay people? How do gay people have sex?" And the teacher was just like, "Oh, I don't think we should talk about that. I think gay people make bad life choices."
I don't think that's not necessarily untrue, but I don't think it's down to them being gay.
No.
Some gay people will make bad choices.
I think a lot.
Some straight people will make bad choices.
Yeah, absolutely.
Everyone, anything in between of those things. Some of them will make bad choices.
I think gay people make bad choices. I think that's perfectly true. Not all of them, though.
Not all of them. I think it's just a comment on the human condition more than anything.
People are people too, okay? They can make bad choices just as much as everyone else.
Fallible, yeah.
Yeah.
People are fallible. Yeah. Some of them are gay.
Well, when we...
Unrelated.
I want that kind of t-shirt. All people are fallible, some people are gay. That's anyway, new merch drop.
Oh my god, I actually want that. Can we get that? Like, all people are fallible, only some of them are gay, you do the math. And it's just like, so confusing.
That would be a great t-shirt. Yeah,
Let's do it.
Merch drop coming soon.
Oh my lord.
That's my favourite quote of mine ever.
Well, I'm going home. That's interview done. That's in my mind.
That's the conclusion of
that's
your
the
study,
conclusion, that's yeah. what we wrote down.
Yeah. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, no, so
you
it was.
You did read it. Did
so no, it was. It's interesting that, you know, it's always nice to see when you're reading a paper and it's like, oh, we did this for that, and have someone on and explain why. It's cool. So how did you find people for this?
So it was a lot of what we call snowball sampling. So it was you find one person through kind of word of mouth or through social media or anything like that, and then they then let you know someone that they know. And the benefit of that is it allows you to access a large group of people, because you can get vouched for, especially when someone's talking about LGBT identity and someone's personal, quite sometimes sensitive experiences. You having that person to say, this is a safe environment, you can talk about that kind of thing, is really helpful. But there's also the drawback of, if you're only going based on the people that person has known, they're likely to have similar experiences. So it's less random, but it's easier to get those people, especially when you're talking about that kind of thing, and you don't have that anonymity. You're going to such depth, you need someone to go, yeah, they're cool, don't worry about it.
Yeah, and I think, have we said this, you did all the interviewing as well?
I did all of the interviewing, yeah.
So you've got all of this inside your head?
Everything. I actually have like quotes that just run through my head on a daily
really?
Basis.
Wow.
All of it's up here.
I've picked some out, but so we've got just before we get to the actual sort of questions and move into the sort of actual bulk of the study. And I say the real bulk of the study.
There is a real bulk.
There is a real bulk. The results of this are pages and pages long. Goodness. Like, you can scroll for days. So I think you had was about 7 men and 10 women, and one of the women was trans.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fair. There we go. Just for anyone wondering, that's how the 17 is made up. And some gay people, some bisexual, pansexual. I think a couple lesbians. Three lesbians. Yeah. There we go. Yeah. I mean, all of this is going to be linked in the description, so you can all check it out if you want to have a look at it. And I would definitely recommend, because it's a good read. It's interesting. Yeah.
Thank you.
Very good.
Yeah.
Except the title. The title is very dull.
I like the title.
It's very long and clunky, but I think that a lot of qualitative studies, they'll pick their favorite quote and make that the title. It's very catchy and cool, and it's like you were saying earlier.
I hate clickbait. So clickbait title for a YouTube video, you know, that's fun and exciting, cool. Clickbait title for an article, like a scientific paper? No, just tell me, like, a scientific paper, the title should tell me everything I need to know about the rest of the paper. If it's like, if it could be the title of like a BBC article or something on like BuzzFeed, no.
What's the title then?
The title is Exploring Reflections, Motivations, and Experiential Outcomes of First Same-Sex/Gender Sexual Experiences Among Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Other Sexual Minority Individuals.
That's a great title.
Gets to it's the a great point. Title.
Yeah, exactly.
It's wonderful. Concise.
It's one of my biggest insecurities of my life, is that title.
That's the best title I've ever heard.
Nice.
But if I was doing some research for SciGuys and I was reading a study, that's exactly the kind of title I expect to find, not like a news article.
That's true, yeah.
It's because it is really frustrating when you're trying to find sort of papers, and there's a title that looks really flashy, and you read it and it's just very dry data.
Yeah,
that doesn't really match the title. It's just there's one small part that that matches it. I can't think of an example off the top of my head, but you know, it's like a super mouse, the mouse that is Superman, and it's like you read.
I want to read that paper.
Examining the outcomes of injecting steroids into mice.
Exactly. It's just like really. It's so frustrating having to wade through all that. So I very much do appreciate a concise title that tells me exactly what I need to know.
A really good advantage of that. I during that same year, I did a kind of brief qualitative synthesis, which is basically. So do you know what a systematic review is?
Nope.
So a systematic review. So you've got a bunch of papers, right? A bunch of data. Mm. And what you do is you go through every database with very specific search terms and try and find every paper that references a small thing. Mm-hmm. So I did the sexual health advice given to people who were recently made quadriplegic, or anyone who has a spinal cord injury. And that was basically what it was. And so you can find all these papers and then you bring all the data together into one meta study.
So it's
a systematic review because you're systematically going through every single thing.
Might have been paraplegic.
Paraplegic. So, the advantage of that is you get even more data, bigger study. But with qualitative synthesis, it's much the same. And so I wanted to make it as easy to find as possible. So, because I remember doing that, and some of the papers, you're like, is this going to be relevant? And then you scroll and you're like, okay, no, this isn't relevant. I have to go to the next one. If it's right there in front of you, you're like, okay, that is relevant or isn't. Yeah. And if more people do studies like this, then they can do a qualitative synthesis and it makes it more objective and more like grounded, which is what I want ultimately.
Yeah.
You keep saying this, but I think this is a really good, we'll get into it, but I think this is a really good, you've laid really good groundwork for sort of future study, which is really interesting.
Now we just need them to do the future study.
It's really interesting because this is almost a sort of tie in to the last episode with Jamie. Well, not the last, the week before last, because, not to mention Jamie again, sorry.
It's
but
okay.
Jamie also did a sort of basically a sort of groundbreaking, the first sort of study in that area about sort of LGBT people, which is really interesting. I'm glad that we're able to sort of platform these studies. And if there's anyone young and queer listening, you can do science. You should
do more.
You should
go and do
science.
It. Study these things. Do it. There we go. we kind of went over the questions already, but do we want to go over that again, or like in a little bit more depth, or are you kind of happy with what sort of questions asked were?
So would you like me to get into it?
Well, I mean, I'd love to know how many questions are there? Are there loads?
So there are basically a bunch of kind of main questions from which I just spiraled off depending on what the person said. So you have a lot of in the actual sheet that has all my questions on it, you have a lot of like what makes you feel that way and how does that, but the main questions were like how did you meet your partner? Actually I think one of the first ones was, can you define what first sex is for you? How did you meet your partner and why, and all this kind of stuff. Did you have, were you drinking, did you use contraceptive, if not why? And there were some other ones like, how do you feel prepared to go into it? Did you know what you were doing? What did you have in your past that allowed you to be prepared for it if you were? And then how do you feel about it looking back? Those kind of questions.
Yeah.
Nice.
So I think you've got it broken down here as meeting first partner, context of first sex, and then reflection.
Yeah.
And then the end.
And then which is just, thank you.
Well, it says, is there anything else you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, there is.
Anything else? And someone must have spoken for a while because the interviews ranged from 29 to 58 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. How long were they? Like, so it's, I think it says on average they were 37 minutes.
Yeah. So there was a couple that were very short, but the majority of them were between, I'd say, 30 and 40 minutes.
Okay. That's good. That's a long chat.
And then I had to transcribe the entire thing.
Oh.
All of them myself.
Dear me.
And do all the coding myself as well. So that's fun.
Dear horrible. Sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah,
How long did it take?
I decided I really wanted to start as early as possible. So basically a year. But how long did the interviews took after I got them rolling, a few months, I would say. And then actually transcribing and going through it all, that was another kind of few months.
Dear.
And then writing it up and all this kind of stuff.
Fair enough. I mean, good work. So, why don't we hop on into the results?
Go.
I think we've got time to do that, right?
Yeah, we've got time.
You got time to do the results?
Yeah, definitely. Let's go.
I mean, I'll probably take a few days. There's a lot of results. So I mean, I've got a summary here of kind of like what your results are. Do you want to give a summary of that before we hop into the more sort of specifics?
Yeah. So the general findings were, especially among women who have sex with women, defining first sex was incredibly difficult for them. And that had a lot of issues relating to the ability to validate your own identity and feeling unable to. So a couple of them were feeling like you're only queer or you're only LGBT if you have had the experiences. And if you can't define those experiences, it's almost like you haven't had them.
Yeah.
And for some of them, they were saying that they were constantly asked what it even is to have sex with a woman, all this kind of stuff. For men, it was very much along the lines of kind of penetration. But there was also some talk of like affective, so emotional ways of knowing, oh, that felt more passionate or more intense or something like this.
Can I just ask?
Yeah.
What is the general consensus on first time when it's a woman having sex with a woman? Because I wouldn't know how to define that in a way that would change the, wouldn't change the definition for other people.
Yeah, so that's the issue, is ultimately we're basing on a framework that is based around heterosexual sex, which is penetrative. So I think that there are some studies that say the general consensus is oral sex with women is the kind of goal. But then I think there's a lot more critical health psychology that's saying ultimately there shouldn't be a standard definition, because that excludes things like oral sex, which has connotations and it also has ramifications in regards to sexual health, or it excludes digital hand stuff and that kind of thing. And when you start isolating it, it can be good for research, but it can also be quite reductive and exclusionary.
Can I just, when you say digital, you mean with fingers as in the digits, not
digits.
Just not for anyone listening or watching. Not
webcam sex.
Not online sex. Digit as in digital.
But it
as
also
in the
it also excludes stuff like that, like sex absolutely, stuff like that. Which is that sex? Is that not? Who knows?
That's what I think is really interesting. That's what's really interesting to me. I was thinking about this earlier, actually, that the whole concept of virginity is kind of messed up. I don't care. I don't find it interesting if someone is a virgin. Yeah. I find it interesting that they've not had sex. Does that make sense? As in, if someone is like,
and you're meaning sex as a different thing to the traditional heterosexual sex,
in any sort of sense. So if someone being a virgin and someone not having had sex, they kind of operate as different things to me. In that, if you've not had sex, that's just an experience that you've not had, which I find interesting. Like if someone said to me, "I've not had ice cream before," I'd be like, "Yeah, that's interesting."
Yeah.
So like, I'd be like, "If you had sorbet," I'd be like, "No, I've never had sorbet," and I'm like, "That's very." What about like a very cold cream? Have you ever had that? They'd be like, "Yeah, I've had a cold cream." And I'd be like, "And you never wanted to try ice cream?" Just never. They're like, "Fro-yo? I wanted to."
What about froyo?
Froyo, right? Have you ever... Exactly, right? Exactly. But if we had a word that was just like for someone that hadn't had ice cream.
Hasn't had ice cream.
Like them, like someone being a non-ice cream haver, like as a thing, them being that is not as interesting to me as them not just having experienced the thing.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? It's the experience or lack thereof that is more interesting to me rather than the sort of identity around the person.
Yeah.
I guess it's like in the old world, the concept of virginity creates itself the necessity for the concept of virginity. So if losing your virginity is built up as this big deal, when you've crossed that boundary, it is because you've made the crossing of the boundary, which only exists because you made it a big deal in the first place.
Exactly,
And sort of the introduction of sort of broader definition for virginity or for having had sex sort of makes that less of a hard line and more of a fuzzy line.
Yeah.
And it's more about an emotional transformation. Like you've crossed into a different set of experiences that a human can have.
Yeah.
That aren't necessarily exclusively about penetrative sex.
Yeah. I think it's definitely something that there has been work going towards that, where people are looking at, especially in sexual health psychology. You go back to the 60s, and it is just the most awful things to read. It's like, you know, anyone who has premarital sex is going to die. That kind of stuff. And then the 80s came along.
That was in a science.
That was in a paper. I read.
He's going to die.
It's not specifically those words.
Hold on, wait. To be fair, not untrue.
Sorry, that is the truth.
They will die.
They are going to die.
Some people make poor choices. Some of them are gay.
Exactly.
People who have premarital sex are going to die. So is everybody else.
That is exactly the kind of title of one of those papers that I was talking about earlier. It would be like, everyone that has premarital sex dies. You read the paper. Everyone dies, and some people have premarital sex.
I got you.
Maybe we should start publishing a bunch of troll papers where we just put arbitrary categories on things that explains everybody.
How are those going to pass peer? Oh my God, let's just make our own journal for just pointless papers.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. Oh
my God. New merch drop coming.
We can sell a zine of terrible science papers that we have made up.
I genuinely...
That are technically true. They're all technically true.
I genuinely think we could do that, because actually this is somewhat unrelated, but it's something that I want to bring up on the podcast at some point, so I'll just do it now. I was looking for a journal of sort of negative results, as in, you know, the results that are not the results that someone was looking for.
Insignificant results.
Yeah.
Non-significant results, rather. And yeah,
exactly.
That would be really good to have.
There have been a couple, but I think some of them have discontinued. But I think under SciGuys, it'd be very cool to try and start a journal like that at some point down the line. So So let's
wow,
let's do that.
New Patreon goal.
Yeah, genuinely new Patreon goal. It'd be really cool, I think.
That would be amazing.
It'd be amazing, right?
That'd be really cool. Yeah.
Awesome. And we'll tie it in with our pointless results and you have to figure out which is which. what were we talking about before?
So defining first X and what implications of that was.
Yeah. I guess the good question for me there is then if you are defining sex in a certain way for women who are having sex with women, does that not then necessarily change the definition of first-time sex other people?
It does. And this is the issue a lot of other papers have. So this is why there is so little research into this, is because it's so difficult to create any scope. And it's much easier to just go penile-vaginal penetration.
Yeah.
Sorry, put that down.
Can I just, this is what's really frustrating. Right, so it makes sense that you've done the sort of qualitative approach here, because if you were to do quantitative, you'd have to yourself sort of
create that definition.
Yeah, mm. And we've had this definition up until this point of what sex is, and scientists, they've come across something that doesn't fit into their way of sort of categorizing things, mm-hmm. and instead of reassessing that,
they just ignore it.
Let's just ignore it for now. Let's put lesbians to the side, and let's just pretend like they don't exist. As opposed to, instead of thinking hold on, our conception of sex in society is maybe a little bit more complex than we have given it credit for, and that might be affecting our results. So
I just feel like it's unboxable. Like the scientists want to put things in boxes so that they can compare them. Mm. And I think if you include every sexual orientation, it's not possible to construct a box other than anything more than kissing.
So but then it's also not, sorry.
That's actually a good
anything to do with genitalia.
But then it's not, you say with other sexual orientations, and this is something that I was going to sort of come in with earlier, that you talk about heterosexual sex, but this idea that there's one mode of heterosexual sex is such a pain because let's leave trans people out of this for now, right? Just forget it for a sec, right?
You're so scientific.
Look at me, I'm scientist.
I'm leaving out a category of people.
What's really interesting to me is that heterosexual sex, right? We have this idea of what that is, but ultimately, first off, pegging is a thing. Like heterosexual sex, as sex between a heterosexual man and a heterosexual woman, does not necessarily need to be like whoop, whoop, whoop. PIV. It doesn't need to be that. There are so many different ways for that to happen, right?
And then
when you bring in trans people, then there's another layer of complexity, and you can just keep on adding these layers of complexity. And we're literally doing it in this conversation right now, where we're simplifying it by saying heterosexual sex.
Yeah.
But heterosexual sex isn't even necessarily what we by its broadest definition, it's not what we mean when we say heterosexual sex.
I try and broach that a little bit in the paper by basically saying a lot of them say heterosexual or penile vaginal, but this basically what they mean is mixed gender, so mixed sex or gender, sex between someone who is predicated by the gender binary as two people of the opposite sex, which is a already arbitrary term as well, and having penile vaginal intercourse. That's the definition. And ultimately, you're right, if they have anal sex, that's excluded, even though that has a man and a woman doing that is that has the exact same implications, or oral sex is excluded and that kind of thing. And it's just as soon as you start excluding, so how I defined it in the study, to get back to how I did it, was I just had it self-defined.
Yeah.
Right. So, and this is the thing with one of the papers that I read, the only other paper into this from contemporary times, they had anything from sexualized kissing onwards, and that's what their definition was, but I thought that was I putting it as a self-defined thing and then asking them what that self-defined thing is, I think is a much easier way of doing it, and then you don't have to create this box and exclude people. You can have the research onto the effective outcomes, and you've already got what they've defined it as, so you can categorize it if you need to. It just isn't hard to do that.
I think this is one of those things where we talk about the sort of everything has bias in it, right? No matter what you do, you're going to have some bias. And this qualitative approach eliminates some level of bias, right? Whereas a quantitative one of saying this is what sex is, you get good data out of that for this one particular viewpoint, right? So it's a limitation of the way that we study things almost, right?
Definitely.
It's such a difficult thing to broach because people want to believe that science has all the answers to everything. But when we're studying something like this, if you want to use that sort of hard science, the hard data, the quantitative approach, it's just not going to, you're not going to get as
rich data
as you would from this. It's really interesting. Do you want it?
So that was the first point I raised in my
paper. Good God.
So the next one, which I went into all these different definitions. The next one, I'm actually going to read this because it's harder to remember. So yeah, we're going to like delegitimization, how that affected people. And then we went into kind of meeting and contextual situations. And it was interesting because what we found is all of the men, or a large portion of the men, found partners on dating apps, and none of the women did. So the women exclusively found them through, well, almost exclusively found them through social groups, whereas the men almost never found it through social groups. There was a couple who did here and there, but ultimately, and there was one woman who had someone they picked up in a club this one time. But ultimately, it was this really interesting divide. And it's like, why is that the case? Obviously, none of the participants, I didn't really ask the participants in that space, so I can only speculate. But we came up with some kind of ideas that maybe it's because men who are seeking first sex with other men, they might want to hide that from their social group. And so going online adds this layer of anonymity and also ease. Then you've got with women, a lot of the time there aren't access to those services, and so they will go for that. And then the other side of it is if you are queer in an unqueer space, you are more likely to attach to that person and get to know them a bit better, which is what a lot of the women found. But the men didn't really want to communicate with other people in their space.
What's interesting though, because it's this classic thing of, and they were just good friends. Like there's all the friendship kiss. Yeah. All of these, like I say, lesbians throughout history, or like sort of queer women throughout history in relationships with women, clearly in relationships with women. And if you look back, they'll be like, and Josephine lived with her very close friend for the entirety of their lives, and neither of them married, and they bought a little cottage on an island and did not speak to anyone. Like, they were gay. Just say they were gay. Like, they were married.
Were clearly gay.
Exactly, right? And it's almost acceptable and or ignored for women to be very close. Like, you can have girls that are friends hold hands whilst walking down the street, right? Mm. And I'm not saying that sort of, you know, for women that there isn't any stigma, there's no violence. I'm not saying that at all. But I think we can all agree that generally it is more socially acceptable for women to engage in what would be seen as homosexual sort of behavior, right? You can have girls getting drunk and kissing. Ooh, it's just a bit of fun. Like, if a girl likes a girl, that's somewhat more acceptable usually, because it can be written off as just having a bit of fun. They're not seen as being inherently gay for exhibiting sort of some homosexual tendencies. Whereas for men,
when a guy says, "How are you feeling?" it's immediately like, "Oh, they are a gay person."
It's
now
a gay man,
and it's just, yeah.
Is that a tear you're shedding there, Luke?
What?
Is that a tear? That's a queer tear. You're gay.
You're
gay, I'm afraid.
you were so confused for a moment. You're like, I don't know what's happening.
Well, of course he was confused, but then he just found out right now that he's gay.
I'm a gay man.
Someone tell your wife.
coming out.
But yeah, like, you know, I mean, like,
this is an issue that some of the women found is when they were in social groups, they didn't know whether someone was coming onto them, someone was approaching them. And so a lot of them were saying, you don't know whether it's just in a friend way, because women can be quite close and friendly, or if it's in a I'm attracted to you way. And so that's why a lot of queer women were like, I don't know how to approach women in a club, because when it's a man, there's that option is kind of always floated around as available. But when it's a woman, you just don't know. And so that was the thing that a lot of them were saying, like, I'd like to know the person a lot better, get to know them as an individual, and then I can maybe have sex with them.
That's also, I mean, there is also, I don't know how much this will come into it, but I did a bunch of research on sociosexuality for a story once that we were doing on SciGuys, and it was talking about that men are more likely to be sociosexual than women are more likely to be sociosexual. So
do you want to explain what
sociosexuality is? The propensity and interest to have sexual relationships with a variety of people in a casual way. And so if a woman's approaching a man in a club, when you say the option's always sort of there, it's because on average men are more likely to be sociosexual or towards the sociosexual end of the scale. And a woman, the average woman is more likely to be towards the less sociosexual end of the scale. And there's probably biological and social reasons for that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's another thing we did kind of put in there, is that the reason why men might go to dating apps is because it's seen as more of a rite of passage. It's something that they have to do, so they're just trying to get it done as quickly as possible. Whereas for women, it's seen as this, a virginity loss is seen as a loss. And so societally, I mean, not necessarily objectively. And so they will often want to get to have that deep emotional connection first. Obviously, that's not the case for every one of my participants. There was very varied between everyone. But it was just, it was an interesting thing to notice. Then we looked at kind of how someone understands sex. We were basing it on this theory called sexual scripting theory, which is the idea that in order to engage with any behavior, you have to have this script. You need to know a script. And the script is developed through education, through experience of other people in your surroundings, and through culture, so like media intake and that kind of thing. But when you have a complete lack of a script, there isn't a way of approaching that. And when there is a disruption to standard scripts, that's when you often see negative affective reactions. And so if there is no idea how to engage in a sexual experience, there might be more reliance on their partner. They might be going for an older partner. They might be less likely to feel like it happened in a good way. They might not know how to approach the situation. And so that lack of sexual scripting for LGBT people might be a negative thing. We found for a lot of people, they didn't know what they were doing. There was a lot more reliance on older, more experienced partners. There was a lot of people feeling like having one person even had an experience they thought was bad and immediately thought they weren't gay anymore. They were like, oh, maybe I'm just straight. Maybe this was just a phase, because they didn't have the idea of how, you know, sex with a woman could experience, could be. And then that came into what we then went into, which was education, media, and the internet and all these kinds of things.
That's really interesting, actually, that you say about, I've never heard of sexual scripting theory. That's really interesting, though, because I've seen a lot of stuff recently online about like all these sort of stories that we have in our culture about heterosexual couples, whether in books or in by books or films or whatever, that we kind of passively absorb. Mm-hmm. And if you actually think about them, some of these stories are not very good. Like Romeo and Juliet is a really messed, like, not a great good story.
Dude, sorry. Basically every romance in any film ever is terrible.
Yeah.
I promise you.
But like The Notebook, where he's hanging from the thing, he says he's going to drop himself unless he goes on a date with him. That's just creepy.
It's an older man. It's usually an older man not taking no for an answer from a younger woman. And pursuing her incessantly until she says yes, but then they're happy.
But that's the thing, is that if you're passively absorbing that sexual script, if I've understood this correctly, and the outcome for the people in that encounter is not a negative, there's not a negative outcome, then you've absorbed a script that doesn't have a negative outcome. And so if that happens to you, you're not going to flag it as like, maybe this shouldn't be happening.
No, yeah, exactly.
That's really interesting and messed up.
It is messed up. And when you're thinking about representation in media, like a lot of people say like, oh, why is it going all over the place? And it's this idea that if you don't have healthy representation of media, of people just existing, then what happens is exactly this. You get these same archetypes, same stories, same narratives that then feed into how people behave. And so if it's someone who never takes no for an answer, you find that this happens with men. So they start approaching women and not taking no for an answer, and that's where consent goes wrong. Or with this lack of sexual scripting for LGBT people, especially LGBT women, we actually found a study that was looking into the media, and they found that the only time that LGBT people were spoken about was either in jokes or in coming out stories. And it was like, okay, so can these people exist in the world? And when you don't see someone in stories and cultural stories that is materially similar to you, be that in your race, your sexuality, just anything, you end up not knowing if you can exist in the world and be happy. And so what someone said, they literally said, like, I searched for magazines when they were very young. That was the only thing available. There was one magazine and it only had butch lesbians in it. And she was like, I wasn't that. And so that was the only thing of I could see. She was just searching for the evidence that she could exist in the world and be happy. And she couldn't find it anywhere. And that then leads to you having experiences where, you know, with people who aren't kind of you're not compatible with, but you don't have any framework inside to know what to look for. And that's when things can start going a bit wrong. But then it was also a lot of people went to the internet. When the internet started becoming about, they went to the internet and they were finding these communities of people to try and understand how to exist and that this is a valid way of existing. Because when you remember that queer people, a lot of the time, they don't have people who are socially similar to them. So going into these spaces is fantastic. Yeah. But there was one participant who was like, well, I only had one computer in the house, and that computer my parents used as well. And so I couldn't experience any of these things. And so when it's, and this is the thing that I remember, there's a huge debate about how much of this should be taught in schools. And ultimately, if it's not taught in schools, people who do not have access to these spaces will end up just being left behind. Oh, they have the internet, they have their parents. What if they have homophobic parents and don't have access to the internet? Then they don't get to see this existence, and they go through their life, you know, when they do end up having sex, feeling guilty and shameful, or like something's gone wrong, and that then impacts them later down the line.
I mean, I want to hop back to what you were saying earlier about if you, the sort of scripts for you don't have some scripts for sort of race, sexual, like anything, right? What's really interesting to me is that when I was a kid, right? Okay, nowadays you've got Miles Morales as a mixed race Spider-Man, whereas back when I was a kid, there were zero mixed race characters, like not one. Like I could name tons off the top of my head now, and I'm like almost jealous of kids nowadays because I'm like, you have all these? I had Tarzan. I'm not even joking. Like the closest thing that I could find, like that sort of where, like, okay, this is someone that maybe could be happy. It's like Tarzan, who part of his family like are apes and part of his family are like people. But like, okay, fine. Right. Sure. I've got that. What else? I mean, like Lilo and Stitch, I guess. I don't know, Matt. But like genuinely, like looking at different, like, you look through all the media and you, I know.
I've never considered that somebody might identify as Tarzan.
Not like, but genuinely, having that like being from two worlds sort of thing. It's, right?
Yeah.
Harry Potter, right? Like it is that kind of like, it is, you find, like if you don't have that representation, you find it where you can. And it's not good. It's
I'm
not
just
good.
Learning
that
why
race...
I love Ed Sheeran so much.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
Sorry, there is definitely not enough ginger representation.
Yeah, I shaved my head the other day, but I am fully ginger. I'm a very ginger person.
I can see,
there we go. I'm clearly ginger. I don't have to rep.
Of course, it's not the same thing. But I did meet Ed Sheeran once, and I did say to him, like, you were the first person I ever met. You and Matt Smith, because I looked like Matt Smith a lot when I was growing up, and Ed Sheeran were the moments I realized that I was like an acceptable person. And I was like, whoa. And that's made it make sense to me. It's really what you said about scripting.
Yeah, exactly.
It's made it, not that it's anywhere near the same level, but it's just interesting to me that those two people were so significant to me. And being like, and then imagine what it's like having something much more socially stigmatized than being ginger.
Yeah. I mean, being ginger is pretty heavily stigmatized.
But the stigmatization is totally normalized, right?
Yeah,
you can say ginger. Look at ginger, no one will bat an eye.
Yeah.
No, it's fine. Yeah.
Well, maybe you should bat an eye. Please, bat your eyes.
Bat Luke's eyes.
No.
But it is interesting, right? That you will find that, and it will probably not be good. Like, for example, it's probably not good that my the person that I looked up to as a mixed race person as a child was a cartoon white man.
Yeah.
That's probably a little bit like, there's something wrong there.
Something going
wrong. The best I got.
But
just you and me, Tarzan.
But even though it's like, when we talk about the media, we've got Love, Simon, right? Which I don't, it's not great. Genuinely, and if you've got like a young gay kid watching that, Simon gets outed by his friends and then apologizes to them for making them out him.
Yeah.
Like that is like, no, sorry, he gets out, no, sorry, hold on. He gets outed to his friends and then apologizes to them for not telling them.
Like his friends get mad at him for not telling them.
Yeah, they get real mad, they stop talking to him.
Yeah.
And the whole thing at the end is he comes back and he's like, "I'm sorry, I should have been honest." And
I should have come out to you.
Yeah, it's like that's you know what I mean? So yeah, I would definitely agree that there needs to be better representation in media, otherwise you're gonna have kids thinking like, yeah,
This is a reasonable thing to do.
Yeah, I owe it to my friends.
And when you look at the media, especially for the thing is, I went into this study very kind of even, but it seems that for women who have sex with women, there's much less representation. There's much less education around a lot of things, especially when it comes to more practical things like using protection. There are things like dental dams and latex glove, all these things that are recommended because you can still pass STIs via oral sex and that kind of, and digital sex. But what happens is one person was actually told about dental dams in school, but because there was no conversation about queer identities, she didn't know that was for lesbian sex. And so she was, or sex between two women. And so she was like, oh, she did not clock when she was thinking about it. Yeah. All of the women were like, oh yeah, no, I didn't use them because I didn't know they were available. I didn't know that was a thing that happened.
Yeah.
And some of them were like, okay, no, I would not use that anyway. But it's having the ability to know what you can, what there is and isn't available.
Being
is important.
Able to make the choice.
Make the right. choice,
yeah.
Right?
I think it's really interesting, actually, because the whole sort of... I think lesbians are really left behind on two fronts, because one, this sort of like... We don't speak about anything LGBT, really, right? We're not... We don't educate on that. But also, two, we don't educate on, like, how to pleasure women generally, that aspect of sex. So it's you're basically being thrown to the wolves, which is really like it really sucks. Like, yeah. You know, I mean, and obviously what you're saying was representation for lesbians in media is real bad. I think most of them die. Genuinely, I think most of them end up dying. And if they're in films, they die usually. Or it's a historical film and it's not clear whether they're like lesbian
oh, they're never actually
or they're just straight or whatever.
Yeah. Two that one person mentioned were Blue is the Warmest Color and Black Swan. Those are the two only films that she'd ever seen. Mm-hmm. And she was like, that's what I thought was lesbian sex. And it was like, Blue is the Warmest Color has like a 7-minute long, quite explicit sex scene in that was directed by a man and had a lot of controversy afterwards because all the actresses were like, it was like a porn set. It was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. This is outrageous. And Black Swan has one of the most unhealthy women having sex with women relationships in media. It's like intentionally, it's very bad. And that was her entire representation of what it could be. Yeah. And you look at things like that and you wonder why people are kind of like, I don't know what to do in this situation. And the thing that was really, really notable that this is a thing that you need to think about, everyone goes, oh, but no one's prepared for their first time. That's the whole thing. You're going into a new experience with someone. But you look at bisexual people in this study who had sex before with someone with mixed gendered sex, they then said, oh, it was like a completely different experience. I felt completely unprepared in a way that was never the same. Completely unprepared in a way that I never was for heterosexual sex. And it's just that, yeah, I mean, it's very clear that this is a thing that is affecting people in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be fair to say that a decent amount of sex education in school is there to prevent pregnancy?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. That's what a lot of the women were saying, that the only women's sex ed they had was referencing pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And so that made them go, well, lesbians can't get pregnant. I can turn my ears off, which is a lot of them said. But then turn my ears off. Yeah, they actively turned them off.
No, I mean, I think the best way to prevent pregnancy is to teach people how to have good sex without, like, you know.
Yeah.
Because otherwise they're just going to be doing whatever, which kind of is going to lead to the... It's that whole sort of abstinence only. Sex education, it doesn't work. Kids are going to have sex, like not kids, but, you know, teenagers are going to have sex. Yeah. You just need to, like, you know, direct them. Mm. But if you
harm reduction, that kind of
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. Yeah. So you need to be like, sex can be good and fun. Wrap it. And also, here's how to have a good time, right?
Yeah, because I don't remember ever being taught that sex can be fun. I just remember being taught, here's how you put a condom on. Here's what the general reproductive organs are like. I don't remember being taught, like, this is how to have a good time, how to respect each other.
And I think more important than that is the relationship aspect of it, right? Mm. Like the sort of interpersonal aspect. That's something that is severely lacking, because that is something that people like really suck at generally, right?
My supervisor, Roger Ingham, his entire career was relating to how to bring pleasure into the classroom, how to bring people conversations about the fact that sex is pleasurable into the classroom, to demystify and destigmatize sex education. And that's his entire career. And I remember in a lecture with him, every time someone, he was like, okay, so why would people want to have sex? Well, why would people, young people, have sex? And everyone was like, oh, maybe it's peer pressure, social expectation, and all these kind of negative things. And then you'd go, why not? Because they want to. No one's ever thinking about this.
It feels good.
It feels good.
And, they want to do the good thing.
And as soon as you bring all these other things, you try and prevent it. You're like, okay, let's put these preventative measures. Let's try and stop these kids. And if you make it about pleasure, they're more likely to be receptive to this idea that there is a way of safely doing it and healthily doing it.
And like, teenagers have been having sex with each other since like the start of time. Honestly, like, you're not going to, if you're going to be like what, Kellogg, and try and make a cereal to stop people from having sex, like, you are not going to innovate anything that is going to stop teenagers from having sex. They are going to do it. I promise you.
You need to give a bit of context to what you just said about Kellogg's cereal.
Yeah, does no one know cornflakes. I love it. That's great. So, yeah.
I know, but the cornflakes. I should clarify.
We've talked about this before, right?
I'm sure we have, yeah. The cornflakes story is one of the things for cornflakes was because the guy that created them, Kellogg, he didn't want people to have sex, and he wanted people to basically thought that eating sort of good foods and pleasurable foods, I don't want to get into it fully, it is insane. Essentially, he thought making people eat bland foods would make them want to have less sex.
I don't know how to respond to that. Exactly.
No, I don't know either. None of us do, sorry. <Thank you. laughs> yeah, so cornflakes were made in order to stop people from wanting to have sex. Didn't work.
Really?
Well, I don't know. I'll tell you this. I can eat a whole bowl of cornflakes. That'll give me the quick energy I need.
No, not at all. It does work for me.
But yeah, have you done a study on this? Have you tried eating anything other than cornflakes to see if there's another?
No,
another...
I don't eat cornflakes anyway.
Oh, okay.
But that's, what would that be? It would be an autoethnographic study. That's what that would be called.
Yeah, is there anything? I mean,
I think we've gotten through the majority, the bulk of what I speak about. If there's anything specifically you want to raise, I think something that was quite a notable thing, I just saw it scroll past your screen, that was quite an important one, was people's understanding of their own sexual identity. Was a huge one, especially when you're talking about this affective response to sex, was a huge one that impacted people. If someone had a confused or uncertain idea about who they were, frequently they would have sex to try and work it out. And in some cases, it was a very positive experience. It internalized it for them. One of the people said, I had gay sex and it wasn't the end of the world. And that was a really good thing for me. It was, it allowed me to feel like I could be safe in this space and I could let myself be open to this. Yeah. But then for other people, they had negative experiences. And ultimately, if it consolidates on one side, it confused people a lot more on the other side. Like that one person had a bad sexual experience and immediately felt like, oh, I'm not actually a lesbian. Or another person who had dubiously consensual sex when he was 13 with a slightly older boy. And he then didn't have sex for years and years and years and years and years, wanting to, and in his own words, he wanted to completely compartmentalize his sexual identity and not engage with it at all. And so when you're thinking about affective responses, if someone's unsure of who they are because of this underrepresentation, underspoken about in education, they're going to be more likely to have negative affective reactions, which then down the line could have negative impacts into their health, their safety, and their ability to engage with other people emotionally, generally. But yeah, you see sort of loads of people like, yeah, no, I wasn't quite sure until I engaged with it. And but yeah, a lot of people, it was great. But for other people, it was quite bad.
What was the outcome for people when you were talking about how they felt years later?
Okay, so for the most part, most people were like, some people were like, I don't really think about it anymore. It's something that's from my past. It's not as important to me now. Especially, so the one trans woman, she spoke about both her experience as a gay man and as herself as a trans woman. And when that she had those same gender at that point, sexual experiences, those are completely like a different life to her. So it's like she doesn't really see them anymore. Yeah. Whereas the more impactful one was her first time with a woman, in which she went from, so it was a really interesting thing she said. I wish we could have more trans people in our study, but we didn't. I didn't have the time, and ultimately it would make it even longer. But she said something along the lines of, I thought I was a gay man before I came out because I couldn't engage with a woman, but ultimately being a man engaging with a woman, there are very specific sexual scripts that it's a very gendered experience. And as a trans, a trans woman who hasn't yet come out, hasn't started transitioning, that can be a very traumatic experience. And so she completely cut off. And then she started transitioning to who she actually is. There was this realization that she could engage in this space because now it was not as gendered, misgendering experience as it used to be.
Yeah.
And she found that speaking to other trans people, this isn't an uncommon thing, but it's not a universal thing, but it's not an uncommon thing. And it's there's a whole well of research right there that I would really like to dive into.
Yeah. It's really interesting that you say that, because as you're bringing that up, I'm going in my head, I'm like, I know a lot of people that I've spoken to that have said that. Like, that is a study.
That's a study right there. If you're a queer person watching, wants to get into science, there is a study. Do it.
Given it's SciGuys funded studies. There we go. That's a new thing. There we go. This is it. Join our Patreon and we'll do it. We'll do it. I promise.
But for some people, it was a legitimately quite important thing. And it was quite interesting. Some people were saying that looking back, it was a little bit more of a dubious situation than I thought. Like someone was, I don't know, 14 year old guy having sex with a 25 year old guy as his first time. He was like, looking back, it could have gone badly. It didn't. It was a very good situation for me. Ultimately, it couldn't be fully consensual because of the age difference, but ultimately he didn't regret it. But looking back, he realized it was probably not a good situation to be in. And that was what a few people said. And then a lot of other people said, just like, yeah, it was good. I enjoyed it. It really helped me find my identity. So it does depend on the person.
One thing that's come up, and I wonder what you think about this. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about is that, so like, if we're talking about bringing ideas of sort of like having sex is just a thing you do for for a nice thing, for pleasure. And that's sort of like liberalization of the sexual education system. And then sort of the older version would be like a more conservative, don't have sex before you're married, / be very careful, / we're not going to talk about gay sex, that kind of thing. I suppose the one thing that comes up in my head, though, is that almost to the opposite, but of like sort of liberalization aspect would be, I think it would be really good to use sort of what your outcome of your study and previous things you'd read to impress ideally on people the importance of your first time being a positive experience. Because one thing I didn't understand, not specifically about sex, but in general, I have a clear understanding of a sort of lack of understanding in myself as I was growing up, was the long-term implications of experiences and how experiences can shape the way that you experience the world and shape your thinking years and years from now. And that's in part the importance of like parenting, is that they can, you aren't necessarily processing 5 years in the future, 10 years in the future when you're 10, but they can do that for you. But in sexual education, sort of liberalizing it from the perspective of okaying pleasure seeking and that kind of thing, but also just giving like teenagers an understanding of how important the decision that they're making is as well. Not in a sense of like, don't throw away your virginity, like that sort of thing, but in a sense of like,
make sure that it's
a positive experience, and we're going to help you do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's the key point there, because we don't teach kids how to have a good, it's just wrap it, tap it, done. And so you've got like, I know a ton of people that I know like from school that their first time was they were drunk, they were at a party, or they just did it. Like it was never anything that was planned. It was often something that just kind of ended up happening. And it's just, if you teach people how to make that first time safe and comfortable for everyone, there is so much less pressure. Do you know what I mean?
So you'd say don't put the pressure on them of saying, don't get it wrong, make sure you do it right, but actually just educate them, like, and they will, and the first time will be good.
Yeah. Here are the things that you need to bear in mind. Like, if you teach consent, if you teach like how to actually care for each other, the fact that it's not just because like, I'm gonna be honest, this idea that like a lot of teenage boys have, which is just stick it in, last for as long as you can, pull it out, you're done.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
Like that is what a lot of teenage guys think sex is. That is gonna lead to a bad time for both people. Because the guy is gonna be like, I gotta last as long as possible. I gotta last as long as possible. What if it's not good? And the girl's gonna be like, this is good, but also, you know, let's do something maybe a little bit more focused on me. Like, neither person is going to be having a good time. Yeah. And so the way that we're doing it now really sucks in terms of like, it's fine for safety, but in terms of pleasure and actually like making sure that like those teens have got like a good first experience, it's absolutely terrible.
Mm. Yeah. I think it reminds me of what you were saying of this field of psychology called positive psychology. And so basically for years and years and years and years, people have been looking at problem focused situations in psychology, like how do we treat mental health problems, how do we get people who are having mental health problems to be better. And then there was this huge wave where someone was like, okay, but what about the people who aren't getting ill? How do we look at what they're doing and see if there's a way of preventing these mental health side effects happening? And so ultimately it's called positive psychology because it's focusing on the things that are good and trying to consolidate those in people. And so ultimately you're saying is, don't just go, this is so important, don't mess this up, this needs to be really, really important. It's exactly what you're saying. Ultimately, let's reintroduce this idea of, okay, let's make sure everyone is having the best time possible. Remember that this can be an impactful thing for you, so just make it good and have that as the baseline, rather than, you know, trying to prevent bad, trying to consolidate good.
Yeah, because ultimately the realization that a first traumatic experience is going to have long-term negative effects is only helpful if you then try and make sure people don't have negative first-hand experiences.
Exactly, yeah.
It's no good when it's already happened.
It's baffling to me that that we do have the sense of make your first time good in terms of don't have sex until marriage or until you're really sure.
Mm.
But that's only make sure it's good in that don't make the mistake of having sex with someone that you might regret. Like it just... It's so messed up.
It is.
It's so focused in the wrong direction. I mean, I think that's more or less the end. I think the one last thing I'd want to ask and bring up is the sort of terminology that you're using.
And
this is something we spoke about a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, about how the current terminology in a lot of papers is not really up to date with how we view sort of sex and gender.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that in the paper you were using sex/gender. An awful lot. Do you want to like talk about like?
Yeah. So this was something that me and my supervisor spoke about a lot. Mm-hmm. So both of them have been in the field for a very long time. One since like the 80s, like post AIDS pandemic. So that's why he's kind of very pleasure focused because it was a lot very sexual health focused at that point. And my other supervisor, she's been doing a lot of stuff about affective reactions and this kind of thing for a very long time. But basically, especially in the queer community, she does a lot of stuff in the queer community. And so we were like, okay, so what words can we use? Because it comes back to this definition thing again, to make it inclusive and correct for the longest period of time possible. So we said, first it was same-sex sexual experiences, because having that vagueness there, sexual experiences, allows for people to be more open about their ideas. Because one person, until that study, was like, I guess I did have sex with that woman, but didn't realize it until that moment, and having that opportunity to have it give that space was helpful. The reason we said same, then we moved to same-sex/gender, because having a trans person involved made us realize that, okay, maybe this sex idea isn't an accurate reflection overall. We kept it in because for some people it was more helpful to think about it in that way, for other people it wasn't. But it's this kind of vague, and I don't even know if same sex makes sense anymore. It might be same gender would be the across the board better thing to say, but then that also excluded, that would exclude the trans woman's previous experiences before she transitioned.
Yeah, I mean, it depends how you think about it, really.
Arguably, before she had kind of transitioned, she was performatively a man, and that's the performative gender idea that Judith Butler kind of pioneered, right?
And also where you are on your journey, whether you choose to get like which operations you choose to get, like let's say like functionally the sex at that point then becomes, you know what I mean, like you could say, oh well, you know, speaking in terms of biological sex, this person is still biologically, but like,
but we actually know that's not as,
no, exactly, that's okay, yeah. Like, okay, sure, if you're talking about maybe if you're defining biological sex based on their chromosomes and you've actually gone ahead and checked them, sure, then but like looking at their secondary sex characteristics and their primary sex characteristics, most of the primary sex characteristics as well, like if someone has a vagina and just because they were like born male, you're gonna say in a paper, this is you know, it's same sex, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and if you check their chromosomes and a certain group of people have the same chromosomes but have entirely different gender identities and entirely different sexual experiences, it's not a helpful predictor of anything.
It's not. And this is kind of where it comes into the hair color.
Sexual experiences of people with brown hair. Okay, what does that predict for?
Yeah, nothing. But are you testing people that have natural brown hair or dyed brown hair? Or what about people who were born with brown hair but it's since born with blonde hair but it's since turned brown?
Classic. I have my friend. Very traumatic.
I can imagine. Yeah.
What if they're what if they're bald? But they do have hair. Have they not shaved?
Agender. No,
A hair.
Agent hair.
But yes, yeah, so the hardest one actually was defining. So we had the problem earlier of heterosexual sex or penile vaginal sex. And the other thing, when people had sex with people of the opposite gender or another gender in the past, it made that dubious as well. And so we were using opposite sex or opposite gender, but then we realize that then creates this dichotomy which ultimately doesn't exist. Like woman isn't the opposite of man. They're just two different gender identities, as well as and there are other people as well who have gender identities that don't exist within that space. So we started going with mixed gender sex, mixed gender relationship with a other gender partner, rather than opposite, which was one that my supervisor said, and it was like very helpful. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think the terminology, we just were trying to get it as close to what was helpful and accurate as possible, rather than going for something that was clouded by societal frameworks of how it works.
I think that's what's interesting there, because this is some categorization. This is something we talk about often. That categorizations exist basically solely to be useful, right?
Yeah.
And we've had a whole conversation about what useful means. Obviously, they need to describe reality in some way. Obviously, you can't be like, well, it's useful for me to think of my TV as a cat. Therefore, my TV is
like roughly relational to reality.
We had a whole episode of After Dark about truth and that whole aspect. So if you want to know. If you want to know about this more in depth, because we don't have the time for it, go over to Patreon and listen to that episode After Dark. I think it's number three? Two or three?
I think so, three.
Two or three. Well, listen to them all anyway. But the categories exist to be, like, sort of primarily to be useful, and people get very attached to them, and then when they stop being useful, they try and say, okay, well, the reality is just wrong. Because it doesn't fit the category. Instead of being like, well, this category just isn't useful anymore, so let's try and move to a one that works better for our purposes.
The most profound thing I've ever been told was from a guy doing a statistics PhD, and he wasn't trying to be profound. He was just saying something that he thought was helpful, because I was doing a statistics project on hierarchical linear modeling. I just wanted to show off that I was smart. And so basically, it's a really, you nest variables inside other variables. It's very interesting and intricate. And he was doing his PhD on this type of modeling. And so I was basically asking a question about this baseline assumption of this model, and he went, okay, so there's this statistician called Box. It actually exists. I know, crazy. Didn't create the Box plot, completely different box. So he said, all models are wrong, some are useful. And that stuck with me ever since as like a very profound, like, existential phrase. But I think it explains it perfectly. Yeah. It's like every model you use is going to be incorrect, because it's going to be limited by how we perceive reality and limited by what is available. And so, but it's going to be useful to some degree, but it's about knowing where that limit is and being aware of that.
Absolutely. Awesome. I think that's a great place to end, don't you all?
Yeah,
great. So why don't we move on to the quickfire quiz?
Dun 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 dun, first time edition.
Okay, now, Ian, I will explain the rules to you, and I'll explain them to everyone listening, and I'll explain them to you too as well, because you may have forgotten since last time. Now, I will ask one question. That is one question between the three of you. The first person to buzz in with the correct answer after I finished asking the question wins. What do they win, champ?
Nothing.
Gosh darn right. So, I will ask you, Luke, what is your buzzer?
Ooh. Sorry, first time.
Is that the whole buzzer?
Ooh.
Champ, what is your buzzer?
Oh, mine's going to be very similar.
I like that one. Good.
Yeah, cool.
Ian, what is your buzzer?
I have no idea what to do. I'm being put on the spot here. Buzzer.
That's quite a long buzzer, but I'll go for it. Cool. So the question for you three is, what was the age range for the study?
Ooh.
Luke, I think you came first.
Did I? The age range for the study was hoped to be 18 to 26, but the actual participants were 19 to 24.
Yeah, nailed it.
Hell yeah.
Whoa, wow. Extra point there for Luke.
That was double point.
Double than nothing.
Double than nothing.
That would have won otherwise.
Not double or nothing.
I have no nothing. Wow.
An absence of nothing. Is that nothing? Who knows? Where can people find you, Ian?
Me?
Yeah.
Find me. I'm just about. I'm just about. What do you mean by that? In many ways, so
online, the internet.
I'm on the internet. I have a band, Bears and Trees. We released a debut album recently, and thank you very much. And so you can follow the band's social media. I'm not that present on social media, to be honest, very much. I might post an abstract joke to Twitter every so often, or a funny picture of bricks on my Instagram, but ultimately you're not going to get very good content.
Bricks are very funny.
They can. It was just a stack of breeze blocks in the middle of the street, so I decided to take a picture of it and write a review as if it was an installation. It was great. But yeah, you might get some fun from that, but ultimately, yeah. Bears and Trees is probably your best bet to know what I'm actually doing.
Yeah.
At one point. I don't know what I'm doing. Bears and Trees does.
Yeah, Bears and Trees. Check out Bears and Trees.
And their new album.
Yes.
It's called And Everybody Else Smiled Back. And it goes through topics of emotional and sexual trauma as well in one of the songs. And also recovery through connection, friendship, and building each other up building each other up.
Yeah. And you'll find a link to that in the description. There you go.
Before we go, we'd like to say a very special thank you to all of our patrons and you. And thank you for watching. You can find the full references in the description. Subscribe to new episodes every Sunday. And why not leave us a nice wee comment? You can support the pod on patreon.com/SciGuys, or you can find and contact us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and TikTok, and join our Discord at SciGuys. And you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at Luke Cutforth everywhere.
Oh, you can follow me at Champkin everywhere.
You can follow me at NotCory everywhere.
You can follow me wherever you like.
Good
street.
Hang on. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Bye. It's your first time doing the outro.
I don't like this. I feel dirty.